Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. It's great to feel the energy in the room. And always tell when you're surrounded by people that love AA. That's great to be here. It's great to get to come out here and share with you guys my experience, strength, and hope, what I've learned and enjoyed and experienced, most importantly, experienced my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober since July 17th. Of 1996. That's not a terribly long time, but it is the longest I've ever been sober, so I'm pretty proud. I'm not an expert on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just a guy that from my very first week of sobriety, I was sponsored by Bob, so if anything that I say this weekend you vehemently disagree with, I'd like all the compliments, but the complaints can go to Bob. But from my very first week in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been involved in going to, listening to people talk about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. What does it say in the Big Book is one of the most common answers to any question that I pose my sponsor, which I'm not sure if that's just because you can't come up with a better answer or not, or if that's because really what the answer is. But I've been driven and directed back into the Big Book over and over again. And so all I'm going to share with you this weekend over the next series of sessions is my experience with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, what it's meant in my life, what these steps have meant in my life, how they've affected me. And hopefully at different parts, at pieces of this, you'll identify and some of it you may not. Some of it your experience might be different than mine. And I'm looking forward to the conversations that I'm going to get to have with people in between the sessions where I'll get to learn some of your experience and if your experience lines up with my experience. So I'm excited for a fun weekend. I will try not to take myself too seriously. I hope you will join me in trying not to take me too seriously, and hopefully we can have some fun. So there's a prayer that is customary that Bob and I typically do at workshops and book studies that we participate in. And if you'd indulge me, I'd like to begin now with that prayer. Lord, help me to set aside everything that I think I know about you, Lord. Everything that I think I know about myself. Everything that I think I know about my program of recovery. I might have a new experience in you, Lord. A new experience in myself. A new experience in my fellows. And a new and open-minded experience in my program of recovery. Amen. Amen. Could you pass me on? My phone is my timekeeper. No, the phone. Otherwise, if I don't have my timekeeper with me, Bob will never get to do his sessions. Probably important that I have that. I'm going to start off this weekend talking a little bit about Bill Wilson, and our co-founder, and about what he wrote about his experience in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and how his experience aligned with my experience. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard some things that it turned out weren't true. I don't think I really heard those things. I think that I said them to myself and then assumed they were true, which is pretty accurate for most of the things in my life that I think are true that aren't, right? I think I heard somebody say it. It happened to be me saying it to myself. But one of the things that I heard about Bill Wilson was that he was this guy that couldn't stop drinking and all of a sudden was zapped into sobriety. And God came to him and visited him and zapped him into sobriety, and he had this white lightning experience that was only Bill Wilson could have. So much could only Bill Wilson have this experience that they called it a Bill Wilson experience. And that I wasn't going to get to have that experience. And that what I was going to have to do was all this arduous work, something different and separate than what Bill had done. My experience wouldn't line up with his at all. I might have an experience, if I did, it would be very slow and educational. And if you dropped out of school the way I dropped out of school, anything that is educational sounds like it's going to be arduous at best. I'm not excited about anything that was an educational variety. But my experience wasn't going to line up with Bill Wilson's, and that what it felt like to me in a way, and it felt like this because of my experience, I think, with organized religion. We'll talk about this, I'm sure, more this weekend. But I was born into a Jewish home, and in that home, what I felt like I was being told was that there were things that had happened a long, long time ago to people that were better than me, and those things would never, ever happen to me, but I should worship those people and be grateful that they went through the things that they went through, because, gosh golly, they're better people than me. And I almost kind of got that same message about this guy, Bill Wilson, that a long, long time ago, about 75 years ago now, but about 57, 58 years ago then, that this guy had something happen to him that was incredibly wonderful, that was never going to happen to me. But if I did not what he did, but what he said I should do, I too might have an experience. And to me, that left me feeling a little vacant. And I was really glad that I was directed to the pages of the Big Book that we're going to take a look at over the next half hour or so, where it really lines out what actually happened to Bill Wilson. And his experience, strangely, is almost identical to my experience. And the good news that is, the great news for a guy like me, is that I don't belong to a fellowship where some people get the gift and some people don't. I don't belong to a fellowship where you have to be a special, wonderful, certain kind of person, the kind of person that quite clearly I'm not. But that you can be in everybody, you can be in anybody, you can be a run-of-the-mill, regular, everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that if you take the action that is laid out in this book, and the action that Bill Wilson took, and we're going to take a look at that action, that this experience is available to me too, which is really very, very cool. So we're going to start taking a look here on page one, only because it seems like a logical place to start. I'm not very logical. I like to start in the middle or at the back. We're kind of starting in the middle because we've gone past all the Roman numerals. I'm sure Bob will take us back to the Roman numerals later, but we're going to start on page one. Bottom of page one, Bill says, "I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises which I would manage with the utmost of assurance." When I was talking to a friend of mine about a period of my life that happened in 1989. I got very lucky in 1989. I was about 21 years old, and through a series of mistakes, quite honestly, I ended up being the youngest executive for a company called Kenwood Appliances. And I was working for that company, and they had given me responsibility and money and applause, and I felt like I deserved it. I always come from a place or came from a place where I think I deserve stuff without hard work. I don't know what it is. If I'm honest about myself when I'm sad, I'm sure that everybody is better than me. But at moments in my life where I get on, I don't even need much of a role. I need a little bit of a role. I need a glimpse of a role. I need the promise of a role. I need the possibility of a role. And all of a sudden, my ego puffs up, and I think that I'm going to run the universe. So I can see myself in this young officer, this guy that's fresh back from the war, that sees himself a great leader of men. And perhaps he had what I had, which is all this potential. Anybody ever be told they had any potential? You know, I used to think that was a compliment. And it turns out what that means is you're just a guy that's never done nothing and they're hoping you're gonna. I always thought they were being nice when they said that. On page two, skip over to the middle of page. On page two, Bill says, "Though my drinking had not yet become continuous, it disturbed my wife." And, God, at the earliest of ages, I had my first drink when I was 9 years old. By the time I was 14 years old, I was every single day that I could, which was most days by the time I was 14, I was drinking something or doing something. And my mom was clearly disturbed. She was worried about me. My dad was worried about me. My family members were worried about me. Everyone was concerned with, you know, what's Sheldon going to do with his life? What's he going to become? Is he really going to burn his life to the ground the way that it looks like he's going to? We had long talks where I would still her forebodings that men of great genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic and most majestic constructions of philosophic thought was so derived. 14 years old, I didn't have nothing like that to say. I would say, leave me alone. Right? It's kind of about as far as I would go. But later in life, when I'm staying up all night with my friends and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, we would believe we were solving the problems of the universe. Right? You get me a little bit buzzed and I'm an expert on politics, I'm an expert on finance, I'm an expert on business. There's nothing I'm not an expert of. And I could see why Bill would think that, because in my experience, boy, you get me in a room full of guys and gals and we're talking and we just think we know everything. I am solving the problems of the universe. Page 3. Back to that time at Kenwood Appliances where I had arrived. I believed that with my drinking and with a little bit of good luck and fortune and with my keen alcoholic mind, I believed that nothing could stop me. I believed that I was on my way to great fortune. A few sentences down, drink was taking an important and exhilarating part of my life. I heard somebody say once, and it was the funniest thing because it was my experience too, and I'd never really connected the dots with this until I heard them say it. They were talking about when they were in college. Now, the reason that I didn't really identify is because, well, I never made it to college. But this guy had made it to college, and he was saying that in college they would have conversations about what they were going to do after class. And he was talking about how they would have conversations like they're going to go out and they're going to play basketball, or they're going to go to a movie, or they're going to go do something. They're going to go look for girls. And also, they might drink. But they weren't always going to drink. And he realized that his mindset, and when he said it, I realized that my life was like this. That he was going to go drink, and he might play basketball, and he might go to a movies, or he might go pick up girls. And that's exactly the way that my life was. We'd get together, the guys would come over, and we'd get together in my apartment, and we'd start to think about what we're going to do for the day, what we're going to do for the night. And the first thing was, what are we going to take? What are we going to drink? What are we going to use to change the way that we feel? And if we didn't have any money to get booze, then what we did before we did anything was we tried to find a way to get money to get booze. If we were making these plans on a time of day where the liquor store was closed or there was no way for us to get our hands on what we wanted to get our hands on, we wouldn't leave the house until we found a place that was open that would serve us. That we were going to drink, and then we might do something else. Booze had become an important part of my life. It had become the center of my life. And exhilarating. You know, what's funny is that towards the end of my drinking, perhaps more, but what would happen is that sometimes most of the fun that I would get out of drinking would be the planning of drinking, the thinking about drinking, the trying to figure out a way to get my drink. The actual drinking itself, I don't remember much of. A few sentences down, scoffers could scoff and demand and be damned. I don't know if you have this experience. I have this experience. I would meet people, and I would quickly size up whether or not they were drinkers like I was a drinker. I would quickly try and figure out if they did what I did. And if they didn't do what I did, they were excommunicated. They couldn't be my friends. Right? And with my friends, I'd get with my friends, and typically what would happen is that their life would look better than my life, because my life's starting to look like an alcoholic life starts to look. But I would be with my friends and we'd be all together and our lives are spiraling down at this point. And we would look at those people and we would say things like, you can't trust him, he doesn't drink. You can't trust them straights, can't trust them squares, can't trust them. There's something wrong with people like that. And besides, they have no idea how much fun we're having. We were never having much fun when we said that, but that's what we said. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. My drinking assumed two more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. It's hard for me to admit in early sobriety what my drinking really looked like. You know what's funny is that we use this word, I don't know if you guys use this word, but my friends and I used to use this word. We wouldn't really say we're going to go drink, we'd say we're going to go party. Let's go party. Where are you going tonight? Let's go party somewhere. Where do you want to go party? And what's funny is that it looked so far away from a party at the end. Like, I couldn't have picked a word that described it less. Right? I mean, there was no cake or ice cream, you know, and nobody was playing pin the tail on donkey. I mean, no, there was, this was not a party. This was a pathetic attempt for me to block out the feelings of my life. I might start my night at a bar, and some of you guys in here are bar drinkers, and so you and I are different. I go to the bar, have three or four beers, and then I go find a party that usually ends up with me by myself in my house doing my drinking all alone, often crying. But I would see you guys when I went to the bar for two or three drinks, and most of the time your night would end up in a booth by yourself, drinking your drink on your own, often crying. We weren't that different, just the geography would change, right? But the end of my drinking, I was a lone wolf. I was a guy that would go out with the guys for a few beers or a few drinks, but I would always end up by myself. Part of it because people would lecture me. Part of it because I would embarrass people. But part of it because I felt so dirty and so ashamed that I wanted to drink alone. Drinking for me wasn't about anything really other than shutting off the noise in my head, shutting off the guilt and the shame. And I learned early on that one neat trick for a guy like me to be able to shut that down was for me to be alone. Because at least if I'm alone, I don't have to look at that look in your eye. At least if I'm alone, I don't have to feel the disgust that people often get from me. Page 4. Bill's now talking about his experience in the stock market, and he's talking about the stock market starting to crash. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market had closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape who bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were my friends. The papers reported men jumping to their death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Where else would you go? He didn't have to say that. We knew where he went. Right? He could say, guess where I went. Right? My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. I was never a stockbroker. And I never lost millions of dollars in the stock market. But, you know, my life was a series of tragedies. I lost plenty of jobs. And I would walk out of that place, those people, I can't believe the way they treated me. I hate those SOBs, you know. And then I would get to a place where I could have a drink. I'd have a couple of drinks. And the next thought is, you know what? Who cares about them? I was looking for a job when I found this one, right? I don't need those people, right? Those guys are no good. I don't care. I'll get me another job. And I get three or four drinks inside me, and it seems like life looks a lot better. I lose a relationship. I crash a car. I get in trouble with my folks, and I'm a mope, and I walk away from whatever horrible situation it is that I'm walking away from. And I have three or four shots of Jack Daniels or two or three drinks of vodka, and it just seems like the world changes for me. It is a magical elixir that changes the way that I feel and allows me to believe that there is hope in the world. When we talk about hopeless alcoholics, and we'll talk about hopeless alcoholics, alcohol for me was liquid hope. It would change the way that I looked at the world. And I could have, my life could be in shambles, and I could have three or four drinks, and my life would seem better. That's why, you know, there is a lot of suicides that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people in AA do end up making that supreme sacrifice and killing themselves. But most of the time when that happens, it happens to people with some time sober that to them they've decided never to drink again, and their life gets painful and difficult, and they're not plugged into this work, and for some reason they're not making the connection that many of us make it through the work, and sober they kill themselves. It's not so common that those of us that are drinking kill ourselves. I think the reason for that's pretty easy. because I could be suicidal, depressed, brokenhearted, destroyed. I'm ready to die. I hate this world, but you know what? If I'm going to do it, I need some liquid courage. I got to take 3 or 4 shots of Jack Daniels so I can get the nerve up to do what I know is right. And 3 or 4 shots of Jack Daniels into my next suicide attempt, life doesn't look so difficult anymore. All of a sudden, the hope is back. Bill continues to drink. He has another opportunity, loses it, another opportunity, loses it. I lost that job for Kenwood Appliances as their national spokesperson. They said it was because they didn't want a crack addict as their national spokesperson. I still think that there was more to it. I think it had something to, I'm sure. I think it was because I'm a Jew is what I think. We'll talk more about that later, too, for crying out loud, you know? But I had that job, and I got another good job, and I lost that job, and I got another good job, and I lost that job, and I just kept, my life just kept spiraling down, spiraling down until I've gone to my dad's house with nowhere to live, and he's let me move in there, and he had one rule, just one. Don't bring that crap in the house. If you're going to drink it or do whatever it is you do with that stuff that you do, you go ahead and do that stuff that you do, and you come home drunk. I'd rather see you in the house. But I got two young stepsisters. He had 2 young stepdaughters in that house. He said, please don't bring it in the house. I couldn't not bring it in the house. I brought it in the house. He asked me to leave. I can't even stay at my dad's house anymore. Now I'm staying at a friend's house, the only friend I got left in the world. Top of page 5. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. I always used to say, it's like the 2 things that I would live, the credo that I would live my life by was 2 different things. I would say that I could stop if I want to. I just don't want to. And my other favorite one was, leave me alone. I ain't hurting nobody but myself. The funny thing about the I'm not hurting nobody but myself is I was usually saying that to someone that I was hurting. You ever notice that when you whip that one out, it's like to my dad who's crying because he's watching his baby boy kill himself. Ah, leave me alone, Dad. I'm not hurting nobody but myself. To a guy whose heart I'm breaking. But I can stop if I want to. I just don't want to. And I was about 23, 24 years old, and I've lost all my good jobs and spilt all my potential and burned up all my good opportunities. And I want to stop, and I can't. Liquor has become a necessity, not a luxury. Bottom of page 5, I woke up, this had to be stopped. How many times did I wake up and promise I wasn't going to drink again? How many times did I say, I'm not going to do this no more, I can't do this no more, I got to straighten my life out. And sometimes I would come to AA, I started coming to AA about three years before I got sober. Sometimes I would come to AA and sometimes I wouldn't come to AA. But I just knew that I couldn't continue to live my life this way. And when I'd say this had to be stopped, part of me means the drinking, part of me means I got to quit drinking like this. But part of me means I got to quit getting sober like this. It just, I can't live like this. I can't live drunk, and I can't live sober. Middle of page 6. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably. There was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with 12 glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. As I approached the end of my drinking, my life became a series of dark days followed by light gray days. But there was no brightness in my life. I was a guy that was simply trying to hustle up enough money to get drunk until I got sobered up because I didn't have any money. And I'd get forced into a place where I wasn't drinking, and I'd get sober and I'd come to AA meetings, or I'd swear off and promise I wasn't going to drink, and then I'd drink again, and I'd get sober to get loaded, to get sober to get loaded, to get sober to get loaded, and I couldn't stop. And I didn't know how this life, I couldn't, the only thing that I could imagine was that for the next, you know, guys like me, you know, they say that only the good die young. Well, I'm no good, right? I don't expect to die tomorrow. I expect to be one of these guys that lingers. I'm 24 years old. If I only make it to 55, I got over 30 years. of this getting sober to get loaded to get sober to get loaded to get sober to get loaded. This bleakness, the horror of end stage alcoholism, the guilt and the shame. Remember, you know, God, I joked before about not remembering my drinking. I was not a guy that was blessed with blackouts. I would black out while I was doing it. It was like I wouldn't know what I was doing. But in the next day, I would remember the things that I did. And I'm not a good drunk. I'm a pee on the couch, hit on your mom kind of drunk. The book talks about that we're often dangerously and disgustingly antisocial. And some of you guys, I can tell looking around the room, some of you are pretty dangerous. Especially this table over here. I'm not sure about those guys. But I'm not dangerous. I'm disgusting. I'm pathetic. I'm shameful. I'm the guy that can't look himself in the eye when I go to shave in the morning. Again, I swayed a few sentences down. Again, I swayed dizzy before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a wiggling. You know, they say that suicide is the coward's way out. You know who says that? People that never thought about committing suicide. Right. And I don't mean to upset anybody who's had a family member take that terrible decision, but I tell you, I've been in a spot where I wished I was a little braver, where I've wished I had a little more nerve, where I wished I had it in me to yank that steering wheel into the abutment of the freeway or take that bottle of Tylenol or do whatever it is, put that gun in my mouth. But on top of everything I know about myself, on top of all of the shame and the remorse and the guilt, I don't even have what it takes to do the right thing. I don't even have what it takes to take that final step and do what should be done. Page 8. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Bill Wilson takes step 1. The same way that I took step 1. Bill Wilson takes step 1. Over on page 12. So Bill's got this experience that happens for him where Abby Thatcher, I'm preaching to the choir, you guys all know who I'm. You don't come to a weekend like this unless you know some of this stuff, and if you don't and you're new, and I'm so grateful that you're here. In the pages I skipped from page 9 to page through page 11, Bill Wilson recounts a story he had of Abby Thatcher, where Abby Thatcher comes to visit him, and Abby has since gotten sober. Abby's the guy that drank with Bill, and Bill knew how Abby drank, and Abby's sober. And Bill's at this, is in this despair. He's in this place that I was at when I went to my last few meetings in the beginning part of July of 1996, this place that I'd actually been probably for the last year of my drinking, this place of shame and fear and disgust and hating ourselves and wishing we could stop and wanting to stop and not being able to stop. And Abby shows up. And Abby has had this experience in a first century Christian group called the Oxford Group. And part of what they've told Abby he has to do is he has to go share his experience, strength, and hope with people that he knows. He has to do what we would call step 12, and he has to go, they call testify, but he has to go and share with the people that he knows that are drinkers and share this experience. And he goes to Bill because he knows Bill. Bill's an old friend. And they start talking about God. And we're going to talk a lot in the next session about Bob and I's experience with step 2. But it suffices to say from my experience with step 2 that when you guys started talking about God, I thought there is no answer for me. There's a great line in the book where we talk to a new guy about our fellowship, and we describe the dances and the great weekend retreats we have and the pool you're going to play and the barbecues you're going to go to. And did I mention there are girls in AA? There are girls? Yeah, there are girls in AA. And when the new guy gets right, there's some pretty ones in Bethlehem, and the guy gets so excited. And then you say, but you have to find God. And Wilson's that guy. Bill Wilson was never a religious man, and certainly not before he got sober. And he had this grandfather of his, and it talks about his grandfather talking him out of God and explaining, you know, that all these religious people, and maybe there's something magical out there. So Wilson's got all this prejudice. And Ebby did the most amazing thing, miraculous thing. Because Ebby's supposed to be sharing with Bill Wilson his experience in a first century Christian movement where unless you find that brand of religion, you're not going to get the hope and the freedom that Ebby's there to promise. And out of frustration in the middle of page 12, Bill says, my friend suggested then what seemed to be a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. Didn't even have to believe. Just had to be willing to believe. Bill Wilson took step two. On page 13, and this is the part that is so magical for me, because I can identify with Bill Wilson to this point. I can identify with all of the horror and the loneliness and the shame and the guilt and all of that stuff. But here's where I get lost, because here's what I think I've been told in AA folklore. And I think it's so vital and so important. You know, one of the things that I have a belief of is that we're at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous where very few people are still alive that could have met Bill Wilson. In the next 5, 10 years, there'll be nobody alive that could have met Bill Wilson. 25 or 30 years from now, Bill Wilson will be a very important memory in Alcoholics Anonymous, a co-founder that we will revere. And then what happens in some faiths, in some religions, and in some spiritual ideas is that the myth becomes bigger than the man. And that we lose the magic of what really happened to Bill Wilson in Towns Hospital in 1934. We lose the magic of what really occurred there. And what happened, what starts to happen is that we start to have a myth. And the myth already exists in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the myth that Bill Wilson did nothing other than wake up one night in the middle of his bed in Towns Hospital on December the 10th of 1934, having been struck sober, and then later came up with a program that you and I can implement in our lives so we can get sober. But that's not what happened at all. So in the last few pages, we've talked about step one and we've talked about step two, top of page 13. Bill Wilson's in hospital. This could be December 10th, 9th, 10th, 11th, somewhere in those first couple of days of Bill Wilson's sobriety, 1934. There I humbled myself to God as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time of myself that I was nothing, and without him I was lost. Boy, that sounds like step three, doesn't it? I mean, I know it's not on page 63, right? But it's because he hadn't shared his experience with us yet, but that's what he did later, was share his experience. That sounds very similar to the third step that my sponsor had me do. And the one my sponsor had me do, it said right afterwards the wording was quite optional. Right? So third step prayer could have different wording, as long as we voice it without reservation. Wilson takes step three. I admitted for the first time of myself I was nothing, and without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my new friend remove them, root and branch. Boy, doesn't that sound like six and seven? Became willing to have God remove these defects of character? Humbly offered? Doesn't it sound like six and seven? Like Wilson, you know, I know it's out of order, right? I mean, I that's not lost on me that it's out of order, right? But he did six and seven. My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt and toward whom I felt resentment. Boy, that's step four, right? He made a resentment list. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Wilson does step nine, or eight. Now, he can't do nine because he's still in the hospital bed, right? I mean, he hasn't left hospital yet. But there Wilson writes his eighth step list. I was to test my thinking of the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as He would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my requirements bore on the usefulness to others. He's even starting to think, so step 11. He does step 11 when he sits quietly, tests common sense, tests my thinking with a new God consciousness, asks direction and strength to meet my problems. Bill Wilson does step 11 and then commits to 12. Because I was never to pray for myself except when my request bore on my usefulness to others. And in a moment, we're going to read another short paragraph where Bill Wilson talks more about step 12. But when this was read to me in this way, I understood for the first time that Bill Wilson did steps 1 and 2 in the run-up to page 12. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 11, and promised to do 12 on page 13. Now, he didn't do step 9. Why? Because he's still in the hospital. And he didn't do step 10. Why? Because he's doing it again. Right? Because step 10 is doing it again, and he just did it once. I mean, promise you, the next day he will have done step 10. Right? Page 13 and a half, I woke up today and did it again. Right? And then when you read that, you could say, oh, geez, look at that, he did step 10. Right? So Wilson went through this process. He went through the same process I went through. Page 14. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric and there was a sense of victory followed by such peace and serenity I had never known. It was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but His impact on me was sudden and profound. This white light experience that we talk about Bill Wilson having came to him suddenly after he'd gone through the process. But he had to go through the process. Bill Wilson, and what makes Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, so filled with hope, is that it is a pragmatic set of ideas that are practical in nature when put in action, can create a spiritual experience that is personal and individual to everybody. But it is so profound that it can change my personality to the extent that I can recover from alcoholism and live my life one day at a time, not drinking again. And that everybody that wants the type of recovery that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, even Bill Wilson, had to go through this process. The good news is if you're on this path and you're walking this walk with us, that you know that the path you're on is a path that leads somewhere. That there are people ahead of you and next to you and behind you, and you can see the miracle and the magic happening in the eyes of those that we're on the journey with together. And the bad news is if you're hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous, that there isn't even the one famous example. I mean, because we've always had the famous example. Well, Bill Wilson had his white light experience, but he had to do the steps. A good friend of ours that passed away several years ago, Clint, used to say, and I'll use my sobriety date, not his sobriety date, because it's as true for me as it is for him, that it is true that I had a spiritual experience as a result of working these steps that was more of the educational variety. But that experience that I had started sudden and profound. On July 16th of 1996, I was a hope to die, wish I was dead, curse myself for being a weakling, can't kill myself, pathetic, embarrassed, drunk. July 17th of 1996, I didn't take a drink and I haven't had one from that day to this, and that's pretty sudden and pretty profound. Let's talk about Bill Wilson with step 12 for a moment at the bottom of page 14. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all our affairs. Particularly, it was imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For an alcoholic who failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could surely not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. The magic of Alcoholics Anonymous for me is this. That I have been on a personal, private, all by myself, individual spiritual journey with you, hand in hand, together, at exactly the same time, doing the same dance, to the same music, together, a private, personal, wonderful spiritual experience. The same spiritual experience that I believe our co-founder Bill Wilson had, our co-founder Dr. Bob had, the people that went before me, the people that I'm on the path with now, and the people who hopefully I'll get to help as they come behind me on the path. I'm excited to be here and share with you this weekend. Thank you so much for my time.
My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, an ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in our primary purpose, helping other drunks. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. I have a sponsor, and he knows he's my sponsor. No doubt. I have a home group, and the people there know that I'm a member of that group. Some to some dismay, but I'm a member of that group, and there's no doubt. And the doubt is erased by my actions. And I'm delighted to be here with my dear friend Sheldon and a lot of old friends here. There's some people in this room I like a lot, and I know a lot about you, and I still like you, which is very cool. You know, the big book is designed like a 12-step call. And the first thing we do in Bill's story is we start to make a connection. We start to, whether it's Bill's story or Sheldon's story or your story or my story, it's one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic to start opening up our minds a little bit as we get to those places where we're listening or reading and we're going, yep, that's me. I don't want it to be me, but it's me. And the mind starts to open up a little bit. But in step one, in chapter three, it talks about step one differently than it does anywhere else in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's unlike what it says in the rooms on the walls when you have the window shades, and which I always thought, how important could something be that's on a window shade? I mean, you know, but it's in a window shade, and it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Dash. That our lives had become unmanageable. But in chapter three, it talks about step one from a little different perspective. It says that we've learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Now, I, from my experience, know that for me, there's a big difference between admitting I'm powerless over alcohol, which I can do easily in a treatment center, especially if everybody in group is looking at me. There's a big difference between admitting I was powerless over alcohol and fully conceding to my innermost self that I'm a real alcoholic. Silkworth says the message that must reach these people must have depth and weight. That means that it's not an intellectual thing that is placated easily. I can intellectually understand and admit just about anything when the heat's on. That doesn't mean I fully concede to my innermost self in that place where stuff becomes so real it becomes a part of you. And I sat in treatment centers for a number of years, and I watch the Father Martin movies and listen to the doctors explain the brain chemistry of alcoholism, and I'd sit there and nod, and they'd go around the room, and my name's Bob and I'm an alcoholic. I could admit it easily. It doesn't mean that in my innermost self where I really live that I believe it. I placate up here. But recovery has to happen in here. My grand sponsor was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain, and Chuck used to say that this is an inside job. It's not an intellectual process. It's not an academic process. Oh, if it only was, then treatment centers would turn out people who are awake. But it's not an intellectual process. It's an experiential process. So how do you learn? And to fully concede to your innermost self that I have this thing and everything that it is to have to have alcoholism. Well, first of all, I didn't know what it was to be an alcoholic. I said it for years. So you could call one. Yeah, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic. I have no idea what I'm talking about. What I'm really saying is, I'm Bob. Leave me alone. I'm Bob. I'm in trouble. I'm Bob. My PO sent me here. I'm Bob. I lost my job. I'm Bob. I want her to take me back. I'm Bob. I got a lot of problems. And drinking is in the picture, and I can see that. But I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And there's a whole lot of reasons for that. I remember sitting in meetings, and God, I was just a young kid in the early 70s, and listening to people talk about something that Silkworth talks about. And if you go to, if you want, any of you who want to follow in this book, you're welcome. In the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth, who spent his whole life with us, came to some conclusions that I think were epic. And they proved later to be absolutely true. They've done the analysis of the brain chemistry, and what Silkworth said in here is absolutely correct. But he said this just based on observation of watching hundreds, if not thousands of us. And he says that on the top of the page, XXV, I, which is our theme song, I, he says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. I don't get it. I know a little bit about allergies. I got a mild allergy to cats. If I get around cats for after about an hour, my eyes start to water and my nose starts to run. My chest gets a little tight. I have a friend that has an allergy to strawberries, breaks out in hives. I drink alcohol. I don't break out in anything. Yes, I do. But I don't know it. I had an allergic reaction to alcohol for years and never could see it. And what is the allergic reaction to alcohol? Well, Silkworth goes on to say, he calls it the phenomenon of craving. And he says that this is limited to this class of chronic alcoholics and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. What does that mean, the phenomenon of craving? I remember sitting in meetings talking about, I can't drink because I break out in this craving for more alcohol. I don't have that. I mean, I get drunk a lot, but so does everybody I hang out with. I don't drink and all of a sudden be overcome with this thing where I'm going to claw the walls and go crazy if I don't get a drink. I don't get that. But the odd thing about a craving is that you don't realize that you have it until you can't satisfy it. Everyone in this room at this moment is in the grip of a craving that you're not aware of. It's the craving to breathe air. And you're not aware of it because you're breathing air. You're satisfying it. But if someone were to come up behind you and put a plastic bag over your head, you'd instantly realize you have a craving to breathe air because you can't satisfy it. So it was so difficult for me to see the phenomenon of craving because I just intuitively, not because I think I'm an alcoholic, I just intuitively avoid situations where I can only get two or three drinks and can't get any more. I'll pass on situations like that. And then I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the mid-70s, and I heard a woman share her experience about a dinner party. And I'll tell you, the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, I spent years in therapy trying to figure me out, and the more I tried to analyze me, the more lost and disconnected from me I became. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and construction workers and plumbers would introduce me to me through their experience with themselves. And we all have that experience. We find out who we are through each other. And I start, this woman was sharing an experience, and I'd been in a half dozen rehabs by this time. And her experience opened me up. And here's what she shared. She shared about being at this dinner party after a period of abstinence and having a glass of wine. And I went back to something that happened to me a few years before. I was about 18 years old, and I was dating a girl, and she wanted me to meet her family. And so she invited me over to her parents' house for dinner, and I was supposed to spend the evening there, I don't like stuff like that. But, you know, I'm always self-conscious anyway, and I don't like being put under the microscope. And I had to go sober, and I went sober, and I'm sitting at that dinner table, and they bring out a bottle of wine. Looks like hope to me. Brings out a bottle of wine. Now, it's not the kind of bottle of wine we would buy. This is a little nothing wimpy Al-Anon kind of bottle of wine. You know what I mean? No, really. It's like something like Blue Nun. It has a cork. No good wine has corks. You know what I mean? This is like 11% alcohol. I mean, geez. Anyway, they bring out this little bottle of wine, and I'm in a phase in my life. I had burnt my life to the ground from 13 to 16 and got sent away for the first time when I was almost 16 years old as a result of drinking. And then I made a little shift for a couple years into drugs, like Dr. Bob did with the high-powered sedatives every day, thinking I can keep getting some relief and yet having the illusion of controlling it. And I switched. So you could have, and when I was 18 years old, you could have put me on a lie detector and said, Bob, is there any chance in the world you could be alcoholic? And I would have said absolutely not. And it would have said I was telling the truth. Because I'm going through my rock and roll, want to be a rock star, better living through chemistry phase of my alcoholism. And it doesn't matter that I don't believe I'm an alcoholic. I am. And people who argue with the truth get sick. And I'm an alcoholic, but I don't want to be an alcoholic. The first thing it says in chapter 3 is most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. I don't want to be an alcoholic. But I am. And they bring out this bottle of wine, and I'm sitting there, and I'm, you know, a little bit uncomfortable. They pour me a glass of wine. And I drink quickly. I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why. I think it's evaporation is some secret childhood issue with me or something. I don't know, but I drink quickly. And because I drink quickly, I've killed two glasses out of that bottle of wine. The bottle is dead, and they're still sipping on their first glass. And I'm sitting there. I got two glasses of wine in me. And I'm sitting there and getting a little antsy. You know what I mean? The conversation at the dinner table had been okay before, but now it's getting a little irritating and tedious. But I'm a nice guy. I don't say nothing. I just sit there, and I finally blurted out. I said, God, that was good wine. Do you have any more? And they said, no. And they went back to talking about Vietnam and sports and all this crap. And I'm sitting there with two glasses of wine in me, and I'm spinning in my head, and everything's aggravating. I'm aggravated. And I finally blurted out. I said, I like beer. And they said, well, we don't have any beer, Bob. We don't have nothing. Next time you come over, we'll get a six-pack of beer for you. And they went back to talking, and I think I'm sitting there. I think I'm going to lose my mind. And I don't know, understand what's going on. I finally had to excuse myself. I went to their bathroom. I locked the door. And I, like a crazy person, I'm going through their cabinets in there. I found a bottle of cough medicine that was 35% alcohol with codeine and turpentine, which is a bonus. And I cracked that seal and sat on the edge of that bathtub, chugged that bottle of cough medicine, all that irritated angst nuts spinning in my head, just went, and I was able to sit there and think for a second and put myself together, and I was able to go back out to that dinner table, and I was able to explain to them the story I made up about this thing I had to take care of, and I was so sorry I had to leave, and we'll do this again. And I went out and I got my car, which was in front of their house, and drove down their street 20 or 25 miles an hour like you're supposed to. I turned the corner and got out of sight and drove like an insane, crazy person, 70, 80 miles an hour, to get to my friend Brett's house, because Brett had a bar, open bar in his basement, and some Thai stick. Those two glasses of wine lit something in me that had demanded attention. I was the only alcoholic at that dinner table I was the only person that was alcoholic. We'd all been alcoholic. We'd all been in that bathroom going through those cavities. But something happens to me when I drink that only happens to people that are chronic alcoholics, but I don't know it because of the way I have conversations with myself in my head. I can't see it. There's a line in our book. It says that, therefore, the alcoholic's main problem lies in his mind. I have a mind that will not help me here. It's against me. And we all have those experiences in drinking, you know, where there's a test in the big book and there may be some new people here that you're confused. You're not sure if you're an alcoholic. Maybe lately you're more in trouble from other substances, and you're thinking, I don't know, I don't think I'm really an alcoholic. Oh, that phenomenon, craving, I don't see it. I don't drink Clavel. I don't think I'm alcoholic. Well, the book says, okay, you can quickly diagnose yourself. It says, and I think this is a good test for, this is something you should know. It says, go over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and then stop abruptly. So here's the point. You're going to go in there. Let's say I'm 18 years old. Somebody's hit me with this thing. I'm alcoholic. I'm not alcoholic. I'll admit to having maybe a drug, but I'm not alcoholic. They say, well, go take the test. So I got to go into this bar, and I'm going to go in there. Okay, I'm going to have two drinks, two stiff drinks. Might as well have doubles because you're only going to have two. Two doubles. 100 proof, two doubles. And then you got to shut her down, and you got to go home. Now you can't smoke nothing, you can't take nothing, two drinks, that's it. Well, I'll get about halfway into that second drink, and it'll become very apparent to me that this is a bad test day. This is not a good day for this test, because that game is on. I didn't know that game. Oh, my God, look at her. Oh, I think she's the one. I have to have a drink with her. Joe comes in. Joe's got good stuff to smoke. I got to have a beer with Joe. Bad test day. Tomorrow will be a better test day. And what happens is, as the effect from the alcohol starts to hit me, I break out in an irresistible yearning for more, and it uses my mind against me to pump me out and makes me think that it's my idea to have the third one. It's not a craving. I just changed my mind. And I never see it. And you know, the odd thing about that is that I was a victim of that allergic reaction to alcohol and would burn my life to the ground as a result of it year after year after year, and I couldn't see it. And I don't think I'm a stupid guy, but I can't see it. And that's the problem with alcoholism. It's not what you can see that's the problem. It's what you can't see. That's why sponsorship is so important here. That's why inventory and the steps is so important. It's to clear off the opaque windows and make them transparent so you can see the things that you couldn't see before. We call it an awakening. And I think that's a pretty good term for it, because I'm asleep in the daydream and conversation I have with myself in my head, and I don't see life the way it really is. How many of us come here and we feel like we're bad luck magnets? Everybody's turned on us. bosses, girlfriends, boyfriends. It's just, we don't understand. How could we be, how could one human being who's so well-intentioned be so rejected? And when you wake up, you start seeing you through their eyes. And it's not a mystery anymore. You start to wake up to the truth. You start to see you the way the rest of the world's all. And now, you know exactly why they fired you. Oh my God, I'd have fired me too. You know exactly why she or he abandoned you and left you. I never imagined it was that way. And I start being pulled out of the daydream of justification and the stories I tell myself into reality. And that starts for some of us just with the reality of the cause and effect of alcohol that we could never see before. I think it might be the first awakening that a guy like me ever has. I had that awakening in the mid-70s, and I'll tell you, I'm a funny kind of guy because I've always fancied that knowledge is power. If you know and you're determined to change, the combination of the knowledge and the commitment to be different should be enough. And I was in trouble. And I get it finally. Oh my God, I have that thing. I couldn't have said allergic reaction. I couldn't have said phenomenon of craving because I hadn't read the book. But I understood that if I take a drink, that thing happens to me, always happens to me. You know, if you're an alcoholic, if you're a chronic alcoholic, you pick up a drink of alcohol, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done, you know? You can tell yourself all night long, you know, me and that gorilla, we're just going to have a dance. Or, we're not going to do anything wrong. I'm just going to pet the gorilla. Don't pet the gorilla. Oh, this is not good. Do not pet the gorilla. And you finally get it. Okay. I can't take the first one. All right. I get it. And I think I'm out of the woods. I even remember feeling this, okay, I've turned the corner kind of feeling, you know? And I was entering into the most painful, the most degenerate, the most demoralizing years and horrific years of my life with the knowledge that I'm an alcoholic and to pick up a drink is the most insane thing I could ever do, coupled with the determination, I really mean it this time, I ain't touching none of it, and finding myself going back to it time and time and time again like a moth to a flame. And there was a level here of powerlessness that was beyond my comprehension. I could get that I was powerless over alcohol once I drank it, but I couldn't get my mind around that I was powerless even when I was sober and I had the information and the determination. Didn't make any sense to me. And I didn't understand what was happening. And Silkworth, at the bottom of page XXVIII, he starts to talk about this thing inside me that gets so sick that eventually drives me insane and leads me back to picking up a drink, even though I know and even though I swore. And here's what he says. He says that, now he's talking about me when I'm sober. And he says that after a time, I can't differentiate the true from the false. He says, and he starts to talk about symptoms. He says, okay, Bob, you're sober. Bob, you're restless, aren't you, Bob? What do you mean by that? Yeah, I am, all right. I don't feel, why? It doesn't make sense. I don't feel settled anywhere. There's this mild angst inside of me, this unsettledness. I can't seem to settle in and get comfortable. I don't have a connection or a place anywhere. I feel aimless and lost. I'm restless. I don't know where I need to be. It's just can't be here. I'm wrestling. Did you ever watch a dog circle a room trying to find its spot to lay down? I'm a dog that can't find its spot. The second symptom that Silkworth talks about is irritable. Well, I'm not irritable. First of all, irritable people irritate me. I am not irritable. But I can see how stupid you are so clearly. And I'm a noticer. You know what I... Now, alcoholics, ego-driven alcoholics, we're noticers. I mean, it's... We usually don't say anything. We just hate from afar. We just notice. You know, you just go to work. You don't say anything because you don't lose a job, but you just notice they're stupid people at work. Like, this terrible, hideous mechanism in me is in me today. Do you ever have the experience that you're sober a number of years? Me and God, just like this. I just want His will. And I go to a meeting, and the noticer just comes on. I don't even notice. I don't even know. Just comes on, and I'm just sitting there. And didn't you hear the announcement about the cell phones? Oh my God, is she going to get up and walk around the room during the meeting one more time? Does she have to keep showing off her new set? Stop it! You had 4 cups of coffee and didn't put any money in the basket? If you share twice one more time in a meeting, I'm going to kill you. Didn't they say 3 to 5 minutes? It's 5 minutes and 20 seconds. So I'm irritable. Life just when you're the smartest guy in the universe, stupid people rub you the wrong way. You know, and I don't even know I'm this way because it doesn't look that way to me. Well, the ego is so defendant, it doesn't look like I'm not the pathetic, judgmental guy, the childishly pathetic, judgmental guy. I'm the right guy and you're the wrong one. It doesn't look like that to me because my mind is not on my side. And then the last symptom is discontent. And I probably 1978, early sobriety, I heard someone refer to alcoholism as a disease of chronic malcontent. That there's something about me that I have an inability to be satisfied with anything really. That no matter what I acquire, and I'm in a constant acquisition mode, because I want. What do you want? I don't know, but I want. More, different, yours. I mean, I want. And whatever you get, you acquire. And I target stuff. Get that job in that steel mill. And I get that job in J&L. Let's have a boat, own a Harley, own a house kind of money. I'll be there. I get that job. Just from the moment I get it, the shine starts to wear off of it, you know. And it's never, everything lets me down and demoralizes me. Only here's the problem. I go in with an expectation that's up here and I don't go back to normal. I go down here because it's once again, life is just that. Once again. And I'm a depressive. Which means I think a lot. You know what depression is? That's when God won't just keeps quitting. He won't do your will. He just won't do your will. So I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm chronically malcontent, and I'm driven driven for acquisition, and nothing ever seems to make a difference. I think that is how, unconsciously, that is how I ended up homeless on the streets. You know, I was accepted to Ivy League colleges. I had great promise. I mean, I had opportunity in my life. I had endless opportunity. I came from a great family. But when you've acquired some great things, when you got the Harley that was on the magazine cover, when you got the girlfriend that all your friends wanted, when you've acquired everything that you want and the shine wears off of it and you're still you, there's a part of me that's just like, what's the use? And I stopped getting up again. One of the last couple of years, I didn't try to build my life back up. You know, always I'd relapse, I'd burn my life to the ground, I'd get sober again, and I'd be in acquisition mode, full steam ahead, trying to build my life back up as if I can fill my vacancies with acquisition. And at the end, I stopped because I knew the truth. Why should I work like hell and try to build my life up when I know the truth? The truth is, I'm going to burn it to the ground before the year's up. I can't stop from starting drinking, and when I start, I can't stop. And so guys like me, we stop getting up. It's like, what's the point? Because you know, why should I bust my butt like that when I'm going to be back in some halfway house again before the year's out? Right? That is a bitter truth. That is a level of powerlessness beyond anything I can imagine. And, you know, this chronic malcontent, I was working with a guy probably 28 years ago, 27 maybe, and he said some things to me, and all of a sudden I understand where the discontent came from. I tell you what I'm about to tell you. I was never conscious of this when I was experiencing it. But in listening to him, he shined a light on me through his experience. And what I believe happens is that the effect in the early days from getting high is so spectacular. And it really is. I mean, oh my God. You can take a guy who's depressed, who's lonely, who doesn't fit, who lives stuck up in his head worrying about everything and he doesn't belong anywhere, and you give me 5 or 6 double shots of whiskey and I'm a free man and I'm connected and I'm a leader, man. I'm the guy. And that is such a spectacular feeling of completeness and freedom. It's beautiful. Now, it's not that way at the end of your drinking because it's turned on you, but in the beginning days, and so what happens is I get sober and I never realize that I will get that job, I will get that girlfriend, I will get that motorcycle, whatever I acquire unconsciously, and I'm never aware of it, on an emotional level. Somewhere inside of me, I start to compare what it feels like to be in that relationship to what it felt like to have 5 shots of tequila when 5 shots of tequila blew my mind. I start to compare what it feels like to make that big money in that steel mill to what it felt like to do about 3 lines of Coke and drink some 151 rum with my buddies. And I don't need that. That's a stupid job. And I don't even know I'm doing that. It's almost as if I was spoiled by an effect that it's a super effect. It takes a guy who's subnormal emotionally and spiritually and brings me up into a heightened state of superiority. And normal living will pale by comparison. I never knew that. Until I started, and this is the point of Alcoholics Anonymous, until I started to get my spirit lit up somewhere down the line through the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I started to get lit up, I started to realize that this feeling I'm getting now is, even though it's only intermittent, it's the same thing I sought when I drank. It's the same thing. It's the same feeling of okayness and freedom. It's the same feeling of being free enough to be connected to people, to be a part of, against the backdrop of my innate loneliness and separation. So I get sober, and I don't know it, but I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented. And what I have is not just an abnormal reaction to alcohol, is I have an abnormal reaction to abstinence. And I can't see it because it doesn't make sense to me. And often I would drink again. I mean, I did drink during some setbacks and tough times on occasion, but more often than not, I would drink again after months of sobriety when my life externally was better than it had ever been. When I got a girlfriend, I got a good job, I got where everyone who knows me is becoming very hopeful for me. When they're all looking at me and they're saying, man, you see Bob, man, he's doing good. Bob's turned the corner. And out here, I appeared to do that. But in here where I really live, I ain't right. And the abundance and the good things that are bringing in my life, they're not making me better. They're actually, and this will sound weird to some of you, they're actually making me worse. Because, and I really got this one time. I was talking to a guy, and he had been in and out of prison. And he could stay physically sober with relative ease for years being locked up on the inside. And he said something to me. He said, it's not hard to stay sober in here because every time I get sober, I feel like I'm doing time and my environment, my insides now in prison match my outsides. What's really hard is you get out on the streets where everybody is free, and then there's you. And then there's you. And you're not free. And you don't know why. And you have everything. You have all the good stuff. Your isolation and disconnection and separation, loneliness, depression, and anxiety is just contrasted against a backdrop of abundance, which makes the ickiness stand out in starker and more difficult relief against the, I got a good life. How come I'm me? How come I'm like this? It doesn't make any sense. But that's the nature of alcoholism. This inside sickness of my spirit, that the book calls it a spiritual malady. Now, if you're like I was when I got sober and you hear anything with the word spiritual in it, it's like, oh, yeah, here we go. Church again. Yeah, I know. That's not what this is about. When I walked into a bar, I walked in sober, and for all practical purposes, my spirit was depressed and disconnected and sickly. And you know it too, don't you? You know why you're there, because you need a drink, because you ain't right. Now, you may not, your ego may not want you to admit you ain't right, but you ain't right, and that's what brought you in the door of the bar. And what happens, two or three double shots of whiskey, and it's like your spirit comes alive. I was talking about this at the noon meeting. I worked in a factory in Reading, and I hated the job. I hated it. I hated the people. I'd go in there hungover. I couldn't drink on the job. I was irritable, uptight, judgmental. God, I hate these people. I'd get off work, I'd be the first person across the street into that bar. That bartender would have two double shots, 100 proof, and a beer back waiting for me. I'd throw that first one down and get that feeling of hope. Throw that second one down, throw a little beer behind it. Those people I work for, I can't stand coming into that bar. And I'm looking at them thinking, You know, they're really kind of nice people. And my spirit was starting, the love in me, the connectedness was starting. It was like a flower opening up, right? Like I was blooming. My spirit was getting better. After 5 shots of whiskey, we're shooting pool together with these guys. 10 shots of whiskey and we're planning our vacations together. I remember having, from people 8 hours earlier, I hated. I remember feeling like I love them. I love you, man. You're my best friend, man. And it feels legit. Right? It feels legit. That's for lonely people who live in a chronic separation, that's the closest to intimacy some of us ever know. You want me to give that up? Well, you can't, can you? We don't give it up, we wear it out. There was a guy, Gil lived up in the Bay Area. He was a doctor. He worked for the White House. He died in 60 years. And Gil used to say there was 3 phases of alcoholism. There's the fun phase. That's when you're the rock star. It's amazing. Then there's the fun and problem stage where you're the rock star through the TV set through the window. And then there's the problem stage where you're laying in the gutter wanting everybody to know that you're secretly a rock star. And nobody gets sober in the fun phase. Matter of fact, if you're still in the fun phase and you're here, run like hell. Oh, get out of here quick. I mean, for God's sakes, wouldn't it be horrible if you be sober 20 years and realize you could have drank and had fun for 10 of those? What all that? Now that's a waste of potential. Unfortunately, because of the delusion of the alcoholic, most of us get here 3 or 4 years past the fun stage. We've been chasing a ghost that we can't catch. And most of us come here because we exhaust all hope of what? Of controlling and enjoying our drinking. That's all I think I ever really truly wanted is I wanted to keep this party going. I just wanted to be effect. I wanted the feeling of freedom. Freedom from the depression and the loneliness and the anxiety and the worry and freedom from me. Freedom from me. And if I could just kept that going, I'd have never got sober. If I could have kept it in the fun and problem stage, I wouldn't have got sober. Because I'm willing to face the problems for a little bit of fun. You know, I'm the kind of guy, I'll spend several months every year in jail if I can still party once in a while. Now that sounds, if you're an Al-Anon, you think, well, that's horrible. Well, that's the way I am. I got alcoholic, and alcoholic means I'll put up with all that stuff for a little bit. But what happened to me is the very end of my drinking, I'm in a place where I am desperate to get back some ease and comfort. Because I feel so horrible. And I just want to get back to the good old days. And I still fancy that I can. Our book doesn't, we don't use the term alcohol in Alcoholics Anonymous, denial. That came in, that bled into AA from treatment centers back in the 70s. We use something worse. We talk about a condition called self-delusion. If it was denial, it would be manageable. Self-delusion is you don't even have a clue. You're not denying nothing. You just don't get it. Delusion is psychotic wishful thinking that all of reality is that it's the party's dead. It's been dead for a couple years, but my God, I don't want it to be dead. Oh, I need to be able to get high like I used to get high. And I want that so badly, I start believing it's true. And I will bet my life it's true. I bet you I'm not the only one in this room that ever drank when they were on paper and one bad UA or one missed appointment, you're going to do a couple years in prison. And yet we yearn for the effects that you can't even capture so desperately that I will bet my life, I'll believe that there's a party where there is no party. And you don't know that till you start drinking and you get to that feeling of, oh, this again. I remember being in a bar and I finally got it. I was sitting there throwing down shots of whiskey, hoping to have some fun, just to get free. Because I'd been sober in a halfway house for some time, and it felt like I was doing time, man. It was just bleak and lonely. And I want to get hooked up. I want to have some fun. I want to have some laughs. And I'm throwing down those shots of whiskey, and I'm just sinking into a depression. And I remembered, it's been like this for a while now, hasn't it, Bob? When was the last time where I was the center of the party? When was the last time it was fun? I couldn't remember, but it had been a couple years, I think. And you don't go from rocking and rolling to being bleak and pathetic overnight. It's incremental shifts of as the disease progresses. It's less fun and more problems. Less fun, more problems, until you've hit a dry tank and there is no more fun, and you're desperate and you keep trying to jumpstart it, and the problems now are overwhelming. And that drives guys like me to places of suicide and thoughts of just checking out. And I end up intermittently in Alcoholics Anonymous. And intermittently, people, well-intentioned people, are telling me that my problem is alcoholism. And because I don't want any problems and confrontations, I nod my head and said, oh yes, thank you for the information. And know in my innermost self that I'm not really an alcoholic. I have a problem with alcohol, yes. But there's something else wrong with me. And I know it because of what happens to me when I get sober. You know, if you're new here, for most of us, by the time we get to AA, chances are there have been a lot of people getting in your face from time to time, talking to you about you. I mean, it's unavoidable. You get your mother and father probably had conversations with you about you. Maybe your kids, maybe your spouse, maybe your boss, maybe your minister, maybe your psychiatrist, maybe your PO, maybe you get really bad, maybe your drug dealer's been talking to you about you. And they all use different words, but it's kind of the same conversation, isn't it? They use different, it's really what they're saying to me is, Bob, you're so screwed up. And if you catch me on a demoralized day when my defenses are down, I'm liable to agree with you. I'll go, yeah, I am. And then they say, do you know why you're screwed up? God, I don't know. I've been to so much therapy. I don't know. I have no idea. And then they tell you, well, you're screwed up because you keep getting screwed up. If you didn't keep getting screwed up, you wouldn't be so screwed up. And so I'm pretty screwed up. I think, okay, man, I'm going to stop getting screwed up. And when I stop getting screwed up, I get so screwed up, I got to go get screwed up. And I don't understand what's going on here, that it is my abnormal reaction to abstinence that's driving me back, not to a problem. It's driving me back to an answer that is turned on me. It's driving me back to medicine that stopped making me better and started making me sick. And I keep getting driven back to it because I don't have anything else. And some of you are sitting there thinking, well, what about the steps? Did you ever look at the steps when you're new and demoralized and hopeless? I've talked to thousands of people. I've never met anybody yet. And the hopeless condition of mind and body came into AA, looked at the steps and went, oh, that would work. Nobody says that. Nobody says that. I mean, you look at the steps and it's like, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God? Oh, no. The God who created hell and purgatory, the God that punishes people for what they think, the God who exists to judge me? I'd rather turn it over to a lawyer. I'd have a better shot. And then, oh, I don't know about you. The step that scared me the most, step nine. I remember looking at step nine and went, oh, no. And you hear those self-righteous people. Oh, God, just self-righteous people just make me crazy. And they guys that pound on the table, and I pay back every nickel. I'd sit there and go, oh, no. Oh, my God. I won't live that long. And yet, the universal experience, universal, of everyone who will completely give themselves to this simple program, we all say the exact same thing. My God, that was the best thing that has ever happened to me in my whole life. Why did I not do this and just come around AA for years like a starving man at a banquet? Why didn't I do it? I was dying. Why didn't I do it? I think because the alcoholic ego doesn't want you to get better. I there's no way to prove this. But I suspect from my own experience that this self thing, this ego thing, whatever you want to call it, by any other name, a rose still stinks. And this is, whatever it is, it has a life of its own, it seems. And you don't think so? Look at the resistance it wells up in you before you need to call your sponsor. Look at the resistance that wells up in you to pick up the pencil to start your fourth step. Look at the resistance that wells up in you just to do something simple, like sticking your hand out to somebody. Or going up to a secretary and asking if you could have a commitment at the meeting. Or maybe you're sober 6 months and your sponsor's hammering you to start sponsoring people. And the resistance that comes within me to going up to a new person and just saying, do you have a sponsor? Here's my number. I'd be delighted to help. It's almost as if this sickness that uses my own mind against me doesn't want me to get well. Because it doesn't want its kingdom compromised. And so we bring some things to bear here that in the back of the book, in the medical view of alcoholism, one of the psychiatrists that observed us made a pretty interesting comment. He said that Alcoholics Anonymous brings to bear two of the most powerful forces. And the one is the force of religious insight or possibly spiritual transformation that happens from the steps. And maybe even, if not more important, equally important, is the herd instinct. See, left alone, I am going to get sick no matter how hard I work the steps and no matter how much I read that book. I have to have you. I think the triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, the 3 points, it's me, you, and God. I need it all. I need it all. Because me and God, We're gonna end up like Jim Jones or David Koresh, right? And just me and you without some sort of spiritual transformation, without the steps, without that change of perception and consciousness that happens especially in steps 4 through 9, as I go and not only look at people differently, but start to make things right with them and have that massive change and shift in my own perception of life and become different and different in my life is, and we all have the experience. You do steps 4 through 9, you start showing up differently. You show up different with your parents than you ever showed up before. You'll show up different with your boss than you ever showed up before. You'll have a different experience with those people because you'll see them differently. And things will become different. Now, you may regress almost instantaneously into being the ego-driven guy, but with a sponsor and sponsees, it tethers you to the solution. It's pretty hard to tell someone off and flip out on someone if you have three or four sponsees watching you. What do you say? He deserved it? I mean, what do you say? I mean, what do you say? I mean, you know, what do you say? Or you have a sponsor that you're transparent with. It doesn't mean you're not going to make mistakes. Oh, you'll make a bunch, guaranteed. Matter of fact, if you're not making some mistakes and having to make amends from time to time, you're not going to be very useful. You'll make mistakes, but the greater leap in spiritual growth is cleaning them up. I think the person who screws up a lot here and tries to make it right grows more spiritually than the person that gets sober and just becomes good. That sounds odd, doesn't it? But what are we trying to grow? The book says we're trying to grow an understanding and effectiveness, and I think that's all born out of our mistakes. It's all born out of our imperfections. And so I get sober and I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontent. And I'm driven by these feelings to the table here in Alcoholics Anonymous to ask a man to sponsor me, to start saying yes to the suggestions that are given to me. And even though I don't want to do it, I don't feel like doing it, it seems stupid, it seems outdated, it seems inadequate. I mean, I've had a lot of therapy. And I started following my sponsor's directions, and he'd never even read Carl Jung. He didn't even know about Jelinek or the Johari window. He had never been in group therapy. But I knew one thing. Even though I may fancy that I'm intellectually smarter than him, he was doing a lot better than I was. And I got to that point of, I think, real freedom for us, freedom to change, that Janis Joplin talks about in Bobby McGee when she says, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. I got to a point where my head would chatter on about how smart I am, and I. But I've got nothing to lose here by following this guy's directions. And I could never escape that great reality. I mean, look who I am and look what I'm capable of in my own life. Maybe I'll do it someone else's way. And I think that's the essence of surrender, is you do something someone else's way. You stop defending yourself, you stop needing to be right, and you just do something someone else's way. And there's nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that can hurt a guy like me, except me. If you went back through my little over 36 years of sobriety, and you were to take pictures of me every time I was in emotional, mental, physical, financial, relationshipal problem, you're going to see one thing in common in every picture, and it's me. No matter what the problem is, no matter how it looks, if you set a CSI team in, you're going to find my DNA over all of it. When I was new, I got this sponsor, and he started pushing me into service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some remarkable things started happening to me. I started to have an experience with God, and it wasn't because I was willing to believe really, but I was taking the actions of someone who was willing to believe, and I became convinced by my experience. And it's odd, you know, for years I came around Alcoholics Anonymous, and you could not shake me in my belief that God doesn't work for guys like me. There probably isn't even a God. And consequently, I would never take actions as if that could be wrong. And I never got to experience anything different than what I believed. And in 1978, I didn't believe in God, but I believed in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I've been living it. I believe that I'm in trouble here and I have to do something different. I believed that I couldn't trust my own thinking. I knew that. I was suspect of me. Isn't that odd? That is a paradigm shift that I wasn't even aware of, because I go through life, I trust me and I'm suspect to you. And now I don't trust me, I'm suspect to me and I'm starting to trust you. And I'm trusting you by my actions. And my life started to change. God works through people. He always has. He probably always will. There's an inspiration in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a covenant that when two or more of us come together for the purpose of recovery, that He will be in the midst. And God talks to me through you. Sometimes I think God's having a bad day. Because you can't really mean that, can you? I mean, sometimes I've been in meetings where sometimes I think God's off his meds. But, and then you get a little time down the road and you realize there was something there for you. There was something. Did you ever have the experience of going to a meeting and you have something on your mind, it's really bugging you, and there'll be somebody in the meeting you have a judgment against. They don't have a good program. And they'll say something and you don't even listen to it. And you'll go to your sponsor who you think is brilliant and he'll tell you the exact same thing that they told you. Well, what was stopping me from getting it from him? My ego. My ego. And so we try here to push ourselves aside. In Bill's story, he said a price must be paid. It means the destruction of self-centeredness. I can't do that alone. And I can't do it once and for all. But I can chip away at it. And I can practice actions of self-reduction. And it never is once and for all. It's at best, it's intermittent at best. It's like shoveling crap against the tide. But if you don't shovel, the tide will overwhelm you. Let's take a 13 minute and 47 second break.